Today is May the 8th.
May 8th is known as VE Day and stands for Victory in Europe Day. This holiday celebrates the conclusion of World War II in Europe in 1945. The victory for the Allies came with the surrender of German military forces. This year, Mother's Day will occur on Sunday, May 12, 2019. People celebrate Mother's Day each year on the second Sunday in May by showing appreciation and love to their mothers. Many people will send cards or gifts to their mother or mother figure. Gifts that are commonly given to mothers on Mother's Day are flowers, chocolate, candy, clothing, jewelry and treats, and even beauty treatments or trips to a spa.
Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, and Amazon are using your personal data? Is that product you bought from Amazon a counterfeit? You should find out. Our website is pcradioshow.org, and we can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet, as well as on various podcast hosting sites. Podcasts of the programs available on prn.fm on the Internet and pcradioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, the number is 641-793-7091. And for those who are listening to the program on demand, you can leave us a message with your question or comments to hank@pcradioshow.org. You can also reach us on Google number 862-800-6805. Start your message with the Personal Computer Show, followed by your message. Many Firefox browser add-ons just suddenly stop working due to the expiration of a signing certificate. Firefox users are left frustrated when a bug meant that almost all their browser add-ons were disabled, including popular extensions such as LastPass, Ghostery, uBlock Origin, GreaseMonkey, NoScript, and many more. Instead, users were left with the following message for each extension: could not be verified for use in Firefox and has been disabled. The bug that is still ongoing is most likely an error involving the expiration of an intermediate signing certificate, as the errors appeared to start kicking in. While it's down to negligence on Mozilla's part, Firefox wouldn't do something like this on purpose, as some have speculated. After reading that Firefox plans to prevent some add-ons working next month if they contain questionable code, this is a genuine bug and it was unintended. Since Firefox 48 and Firefox ESR 52, Firefox extensions need to be signed. Firefox will block the installation of extensions with invalid certificates or no certificates, and that is causing the widespread issue on user systems. What's the alternative? Well, you can switch to an alternative browser until it's fixed, or just start using a different browser. Windows 10's May update won't work on PCs with USB storage or SD cards, but users can remove those devices and restart the update. Microsoft notified its users that the May Windows 10 update won't install on PCs using USB storage or SD cards. As a workaround, users will need to remove any USB thumb drives, USB-based external hard drives, or SD cards and then restart the update. Only users updating from Windows 10 version 18.03 released April 2018 or Windows 10 version 18.09 released October 2018 will run into this issue. Users running older versions of Windows 10 should be able to install the May update without any problems. No more than 1 hour of screen time for kids under five. Says whom? The World Health Organization says it's important to a child's healthy development that screens not become integral too soon. A report released last week said children under 5 years old should be spending less time staring at screens and more time playing to be healthy. The World Health Organization is concerned that too much screen time paired with sedentary behavior in children under five can lead to inadequate sleep and low activity levels. Improving physical activity, reducing sedentary time and ensuring quality sleep in young children will improve their physical, mental health, and well-being, and help prevent childhood obesity and associated diseases late in life. Here are the World Health Organization's recommendations on screen time. For infants under one, no screen time at all. Infants should be active several times a day through floor-based play. If the baby isn't mobile, they should have at least 30 minutes of tummy time throughout the day. Infants shouldn't be restrained for more than 1 hour at a time in strollers, high chairs, or strap-on carriers. Screen time isn't recommended for one-year-olds, and the World Health Organization suggests less than an hour a day for two-year-olds, and children 1 to 2 years old should have about 3 hours of physical activity throughout the day and not be restrained for more than 1 hour at a time. 3 to 4 year olds shouldn't go over 1 hour of screen time. Kids this age should participate in about 3 hours worth of physical activity per day. Beware of the One Ring Robocall scam. The Federal Communications Commission issued a warning about this type of scam call last week. And according to the alert, if you are called several times in a row with only one ring each call, then whoever's behind the calls is probably trying to get you to call the number back. If you were to return the call, a person or recording might answer in an effort to keep you on the phone. And as you try to make sense of the call, you'll be taking on expensive toll charges, much like if you were to call a 900 number. But you probably wouldn't know it until you got the phone bill. The per-minute rate of making the call would depend on your carrier, your location, and how long you spend on the line. This specific type of scam call is known as One Ring for One Telephone Ring, and it's one iteration of International Revenue Share Fraud. International Revenue Share Fraud is when fraudsters intentionally drive phone calls to premium rate phone numbers, and these fraudsters get a kickback from the call. According to the FCC, recent reports show a surge in these One Ring scam calls happening in recent days in Arizona and in New York, largely coming from a 222 country code, which belongs to Mauritania, Africa, and from 232, the country code for Sierra Leone. The FCC has asked targets of this type of scam to file a complaint with the agency. There is a Harvard review on some of the misconceptions in the gig economy. Every day there are news stories about the so-called gig economy where workers contribute part of full-time labor, not as employees with benefits, but as independent contractors. The gig economy has not only turned millions of Americans into contractors, but it's given the more successful entrepreneurs the tools to grow even faster. A fast-moving startup can secure talent as it needs it, outsource tasks like payroll, and stay lean and mean indeed. But there are misconceptions about gig work. There is a common perception that somehow the millennial generation just loves part-time gig employment. But a recent study found a more complicated picture. 60% of millennials, those born between 1981 and 1996, were not involved in the gig economy at all, and only 24% report earning money from the gig economy. In fact, the percentage of millennials with full-time careers is rising at a brisk clip from 45% in 2016 to 66% in 2018, according to the data collected. That reflects a growing economy that's offering more full-time employment, but it also shows a generation that may want the same thing as their parents, steady jobs with clear advancement track and benefits such as health insurance and paid time off. The size of the gig economy and how fast it's growing also seems to be overimagined at times. The measurements can vary a lot, and so can the predictions for how much it's likely to expand. Back in 2013, a much-touted survey suggested that by 2020, just over a year from now, a whopping 40% of the workforce would be so-called contingent workers, a number that would include contractors, temps, and self-employed. But here are the facts. The best estimates, according to the Gig Economy Data Hub, a joint project of Cornell University's Institute of Labor Relations and the Aspen Institute, put the percentage at around 30%. That's a lot, and it's growing. But they don't think the world as you know is completely disappearing. Only about 10% of workers rely on gig arrangements for their full-time jobs. Most workers are still grabbing extra hours the old-fashioned way, temp work on the side. An annual global survey of middle-market company leaders found some movement away from the part-time and gig hiring. Most companies are still committed to full-time hires for all of the advantages that bestows: loyalty, retained knowledge, institutional memory, stealing top talent from the competition. In many cases, you have jobs in which workers is integral to a team or needs to be supervised. That's why so many of the entrepreneurs use the gig economy where they can, but they also have a deep and abiding interest in hiring great full-time talent. A gig-based business can't transmit a culture in a traditional sense. You have individuals doing things you have no supervision of, other than the work itself. While the gig economy can benefit companies and is likely to expand, it's not for every business. There's a perception that gig jobs are dead-end jobs. Not true at all. On a global basis, a lack of skilled talent is still a bigger headache for the United States companies than for those in other countries, with 20% of U.S. survey respondents citing this as a challenge to growth compared to 10% of their counterparts elsewhere. With the United States unemployment at a historic 40-year low, there just aren't the numbers of suitably qualified people in the talent pool to hire. While the gig economy isn't the answer to all problems, it can help startups meet their talent needs at lower cost and help mature companies to grow. It can also be a surprising boon to baby boomers and Generation Xers when they were raised at a time when there weren't just a lot of options and now there are so many choices. For people who didn't grow up that way, it can feel overwhelming. They realize they have a lot of skills that companies want, and with all these options, it's kind of cool. The IT job market and the gig economy. A gig economy is a free market system in which temporary positions are common and organizations contract with independent workers for short-term engagements. The term gig is a slang word meaning a job for a specified period of time and is typically used in referring to musicians. Examples of gig employees in the workforce could include freelancers, independent contractors, project-based workers, and temporary or part-time hires. The trend toward a gig economy has begun as a study by Intuit predicted that by 2020, 40% of American workers would be independent contractors. There are a number of forces behind the rise in short-term jobs. For one thing, in the digital age, the workforce is increasingly mobile and work can increasingly be done from anywhere so that job and location are decoupled. That means that freelancers can select among temporary jobs and projects around the world, while employers can select the best individuals for specific projects from a larger pool than available in a given area. The rapid rise of temporary work arrangements, collectively known as the gig economy, has offered people flexible working arrangements and a way to make extra money with the push of a button. This rising sector of the American economy has been lauded and denounced with equal fervor. Proponents say the gig economy creates additional opportunity, while detractors claim gig represents a specific type of exploitation. We, as a society, are immersed in a new era of work that's more project-focused and independent than ever before. Long before are the days of working for a company for 25 years to get that gold watch. The 9-to-5 and brick-mortar office jobs isn't the only option anymore. Freelance jobs are helping workers reclaim their independence. According to a study by the Freelance Union, the numbers tell all. Approximately 57.3 million Americans are doing freelance work, up from 55 million in 2016, comprising 36% of the entire workforce. This figure will rise to 50% in 2020, according to a recent Time magazine article. The Freelancers Union says freelancers contribute to an estimated $1.4 trillion to the U.S. economy annually, and 63% of respondents started freelancing more by choice than necessity. Beyond figuring out your lifestyle priorities, To be successful as a freelancer or gig economy worker, you've got to cultivate the right skills. Many of those skills revolve around technology. To pinpoint the most highly sought-after skills that companies look for in their contract workers, Fit Small Business analyzed data from freelancing websites, including Upwork, Freelancer, People Per Hour, Hubstaff, and Guru. The highest-paying gig economy jobs of 2018 are all information technology-related. The highest-paying job is deep learning. Deep learning is a category of machine learning that entails the development of neural networks that are inspired by and similar to those of the human brain, without needing labeled or structured data to function. According to Indeed.com, the average per hour rate is $115 an hour. These professionals have skills in algorithms and programming language such as TensorFlow, Python, R, Java, MATLAB, Perl, and C++. With the massive size of cryptocurrency over the past few years, it's no surprise that blockchain jobs are the second highest paid category in the gig economy, with an average hourly rate of $87 an hour. Blockchain freelancers should be experts in C++, Python, and Solidity. More and more robotics and technology companies are revealing advanced robots and automated technologies to help streamline tasks and make operations more efficient. However, there is still a need for people to fill robotic jobs. That is why this area is the third highest paying gig economy job with an average hourly rate of $77 an hour, with skills in mechanical engineering software such as SolidWorks Professional, PhotoView 360, Simplify 3D, and eDrawings. Penetration testers, also known as ethical hackers, are incredibly helpful to companies in checking their systems for potential security vulnerabilities and protecting them from criminal hackers. The average hourly pay for freelance penetration testers is $66 an hour. Bitcoin is an extremely volatile market, with some people predicting that it will crash completely and others betting that it's a positive future. Bitcoin freelancers typically make $65 an hour, and they have expertise in Python, JavaScript, Ruby, PHP, and other programming languages. Unlike traditional servers that run all the time and charge for the space an application takes up even when not in use, freelancers who specialize in Amazon Web Services Lambda know how to write and load code for Lambda and are proficient in Python, Java, and C#. The average hourly pay for freelance AWS Lambda jobs is $51 per hour. Virtual reality freelancing is the seventh highest paid gig economy job with an average hourly rate of $50 an hour. Virtual reality freelancers are typically responsible for developing algorithms and have backgrounds in 3D modeling and scanning. To excel in these roles, freelancers must also be fluent in C#, C, and C++. React.js is a JavaScript library for creating user interfaces primarily used by front-end software developers. The average hourly pay for React.js jobs is $46 an hour. Entertainment, production, marketing, advertising, and other major industries rely on Apple's Final Cut Pro X for video editing. The average hourly pay for these types of freelancers is $37 an hour. Instagram is one of the most popular social platforms. To be a freelance Instagram marketer, you should understand the platform and its algorithms, be able to create engaging content. Instagram marketing freelancers typically make $31 an hour. What are the factors that have created such rapid growth in the gig economy? Foremost is the internet, and more specifically, online marketplaces for services. Traditional hiring through human resource departments is waning. Businesses are turning to the web to scout and hire talent because it's faster and cheaper than the traditional hiring process. Prospects increasingly use the web to find gigs, enabling them to cast a wide net for employers and market themselves in creative ways. Online marketplaces are springing up to to meet this demand and make hiring as simple and quick as buying a cup of coffee. When you can fulfill your employment needs with a few clicks, it makes sense to power up and down to meet the needs of each project rather than engaging full-time employees. This trend in the services economy mirrors what happened in the goods economy. With the advent of the web, online marketplaces such as Amazon and eBay made it fast, easy, and cost-effective to buy goods on the internet. Brick-and-mortar shops still exist, of course, but clearly the internet took a huge bite of the market. HR departments are scrambling to reinvent themselves. A second major reason is the technology empowers people to work from anywhere. When you've got a sophisticated computer, being chained to a desk job doesn't make a whole lot of sense. This means we can write code, design masterpieces, and close million-dollar deals no matter where we are, the beach, the coffee shop, the sofa, or wherever you are. It makes the need to take the rush hour of public transportation or driving to the office in bumper-to-bumper traffic, well, passé. The third reason is follow the money. People are not only surviving working independently, they're thriving. As the demand for remote workers increases, the new labor force of entrepreneurs that we call the gig economy has risen to meet the demand. That means there is simply more opportunity and, of course, cash out there for people to work independently. Keep in mind that self-employed people tend to hire other self-employed people, creating a cycle of independent job creation. The fourth reason is we want control. Our lives are more complicated, fluid, and longer than ever. We make multiple career changes over the course of our existence. Rather than sticking it out at one company, we go back to school in our 60s and have our first kids in our 40s, and we're constantly reinventing ourselves, trying to find our passions, do what we love, and lead fulfilling lives. And we need to be flexible to meet these dynamics. A set schedule where you answer to the boss for every second of the day, it doesn't match reality. Working independently gives us control over our time and allows us to be nimble in a rapidly changing world. And reason number five, brand building isn't just for the big guys. The opportunities to promote ourselves and our business are vast, and it doesn't take a whole lot of marketers. We can create promo videos with our phones, access rich market research via and find potential customers easily on the web. Gone are the days when creating a brand was limited to big corporations and the advertising agencies. Online marketplaces are rising to meet this need by providing ways to get your promotional materials out there. The best of them make it easy to broadcast your work, cull customer reviews, and generally make a splash. The world of work is morphing. Platforms and networks are being born. Digitization has also contributed directly to a decrease in jobs as software replaces some types of work to maximize time efficiency. Other influences include financial pressures on businesses, leading to a flexible workforce and the entrance of the millennial generation into the labor market. The current reality is that people tend to change jobs several times throughout their working lives, and the gig economy can be seen as an evolution of that trend. In a gig economy, businesses save resources in terms of benefits, office space, and training. They also have the ability to contract with people for specific projects who might be too high priced to maintain on staff. From the perspective of the freelancer, a gig economy can improve work-life balance over what is possible in most jobs. Ideally, the model is powered by independent workers selecting jobs that they are interested in, rather than one in which people are forced into a position where, unable to attain employment, they pick up whatever temporary gigs they can land. Gig work comes with a set of pros and cons for workers. To start, gig workers benefit by gaining more latitude over their schedule and the type of work they create. That independence is refreshing for some workers. For those working in the gig economy, this lifestyle provides more flexibility in that those working a gig can work where they want, how they want, and when they want. For the freelance workers, the gig economy cuts both ways, though. the other side of the coin isn't so glamorous. Gig workers also run the risk of inconsistent employment, meaning they must either chase down their own freelance work or hustle in the on-demand space. When working in the gig economy, sometimes you do not feel the stability that you have if you were to work for a company. You do not know if you have a daily job, and this uncertainty is not for everyone. Another drawback is that gig workers have to keep track of their own taxes and their own accounting. Is freelance work in the gig economy for you? If you have difficulty in seeking employment because of disruption in the marketplace in the business where you are employed, or there has been downsizing and you have difficulty finding work, then you should consider freelance work while you're looking for permanent employment. You can succeed in freelance work if you are conscious of the pros and cons of such work. The pros of freelancing is the freedom with a flexible schedule, hours, and location. You are the owner, and you call the shots. You have selectivity with clients, choosing who you want to work with, and unlimited earning potential. You control the commute and the commuting costs. There is no office politics and annual performance reviews. Cons of freelancing is the need to learn new skills. You may feel isolated as you are hustling 24/7 for new gigs. There is inconsistent work and cash flow as you juggle multiple clients. Instead of having one boss, you may have several clients to answer to. There is no paid time off, no maternity or paternity leave, no company-sponsored health benefits or 401k plans, no one to back you up if you're sick or injured, and no eligibility for unemployment benefits and COBRA. You run every part of the business: sales, marketing, invoicing, signing, contracts, troubleshooting technology, keeping track of tax-deductible business expenses, and making estimated tax payments. You get to pursue projects where you have a passion, though. Some workers have struggled with finding a good gig, one that includes fair compensation and a potential pathway to full-time employment. There are several ways to identify and differentiate a good gig from a bad or dead-end one. By keeping an eye out for these signs, gig workers can latch onto a company that only takes care of them in the short term, but possibly opens up opportunities for advancement and more freelance work down the road. For employers, the gig economy is also a hit-or-miss opportunity. On one hand, the benefit of using freelancers are plenty. You can hire freelancers for various parts of a project when needed. You hire other people as other projects come up. Some of the most notable benefits of leveraging gig workers are lower cost freelancers compared to local workers, working with multiple specialized freelancers, hiring people in different time zones for around-the-clock work, and the ability to scale easily as the business grows. It can be a mixed bag, though, when it comes to a reliability and project completion. It may be difficult to find reliable freelancers who can keep up a high quality of work. What you need to know about the future of the job search. Searching for a new job and finding the right person for a role is undeniably a task within itself for the job seekers and talent acquisition professionals alike. We have this evening from Benjamin Rockwell his IT Pro Series Tech Support 3 of 5.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and I've been an IT professional since the days of DOS. I'm here to impart my knowledge from both sides of the technical experience to help you challenge your tech problems. This is part 3 in a 5-part series on technical support and working it better for your advantage. Last week, I prepared you for the call. We had you making a bunch of notes. We had you setting up a nice little bit of chamomile tea, sipping it, getting all set, use the restroom, all that. This week is actually making the call. Now, when the person answers, you need to perform the same kind of charm that you would with someone that you want a favor from. This tact and diplomacy may be dialed back a little bit later on, but it is needed as much as you can for at least the first 3 levels, and really at the beginning of every brand new level. You're always going to calmly, easily, just matter-of-factly advise them, this is my name. You're going to give them your callback number immediately. They may be asking for this, and that's okay too. You're going to ask them kindly for their name. You want to repeat this back at each chance you get. It engages them. Ask for their title. You also want an operator number or employee ID number, something that really notes that John Smith is this John Smith. You also want to see if they have a direct local line in case you get disconnected. Now, you may not get all of these items, and it's okay. I want you to just try kindly, easily to get everything you can. Through this, you also want to establish your reliance upon them, the technical support, for fixing the problem or guiding you in the right direction. Now, they'll have just a bunch of things they're going to ask you to answer. They're trying to establish you as a customer, but then they'll move on to the script. At some point in time, they will generate a case number. If you don't get a case number very quickly, make a note. After they do a couple of questions, say, you know, I didn't get that case number. I know this sounds a little bit broken up, and that's okay. I want to have you just establishing bits and pieces of information whenever you can. This case number attaches your problem to a number in their system, and then it starts to record all of this. This will help you save time if you accidentally lose connection. When you get to this point, as needed, advise them that you might have performed certain tasks already. You want to also establish a skill level to them. If you say you're a novice, they're going to treat you differently if you ask for their patience. I'm just really new at all this computer stuff. Can you just slow down a little bit? That's great. Just you're laying them up. You're helping them understand where you're at. If you're intermediate, you're an expert, you might advise them that you've tried many of the standard things. You might have said, yes, I've already rebooted. I did this particular command, that particular adjustment, this configuration. And also ask them to be more upfront on their intentions from the script. And that may or may not happen, but sometimes we'll see on a script, they'll say, okay, first you're going to press the start button. Then you're going to type in control panel. And then, yeah, you know where they're going. You find out very quickly or not so quickly. You can say, hey, you can just tell me to go to the network panel. I'll get there. If you have to repeat tasks, it's okay. Do them willingly for now. Sometimes the first level, that script reader, can't handle much more than this. You're going to humor them and yourself. You want to make sure that you're doing due diligence. Document all of the steps on the cheat sheet or that pad of paper that you had. If you run out of room on the cheat sheet, you're going to grab the pad. You're going to write down tech 1, tech 2, or whatever you need to on the top of the page, Jonathan. Don't put two technicians on the same page. Whenever we get into escalation, we're going to create a brand new page for them. You want to keep your notes simple, succinct. That's all good. But you want to make sure you note these things down. At the same time, record keeping is crucial, but I don't want you to slow down anything. It'll help us later. You're making notes, and it's better to be quick, actually, for the technician than for you to get every word for word down. Use shorthand of some sort, but also be responsive to the technician. Maybe later on you'll catch up. You can make your notes during those times when you're on hold. Oh, please hold. Okay, great. Note it down while the music's playing. You're waiting for the computer to reboot. Okay, we rebooted the computer. Before we did that, we did this, we did this, we did this. Whatever it is. Whenever you're starting a program, if a program takes 10 seconds to start, you click on start and then you just start jotting down things whenever you can find the time. Also, every chance you get, I want you to write down something nice about the technician on your pad. This is worth it. This is really worth it. It comes into play later on, but it also keeps you thinking positively about this technician. Do your best on this. The technician at this level is going to try a number of different things, as they're responsible for another statistic, which is called first call resolution. They're hoping to keep that number high, as well as the length of time for resolution very low, in order to keep their very job. At a certain point, yes, we're going to come to a point where you will be presented with one of two paths to the same destination. That is, you're going to have to get escalated. Now, next week, we're going to talk about escalation, but for right now, the best thing you can do in this entire mix is just stay calm, just document, and do whatever it is that they're requesting. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. The world according to Facebook, or rather, the world according to Mark Zuckerberg. Facebook now says millions of Instagram users had their passwords stored in plain text. Facebook and Facebook Lite users were stored in plain text on its servers. At the time, Facebook said only tens of thousands of Instagram users were affected. Now, well, Facebook has updated the post to say millions of Instagram users had their passwords stored in plain text on its servers. They claim that these stored passwords were not internally abused or improperly accessed, and says it will notify the users with exposed passwords. Krebs on Security reports that more than 20,000 Facebook employees had access to the plain text passwords, which dates back as far as 2012. Regardless of whether or not you've been notified by Facebook of a breach, it would be a good idea to change your Facebook and Instagram passwords, as well as the passwords on any other login that share those passwords. The other option you have is just drop all Facebook accounts. Does Facebook have any parts of the organization with responsibilities in legal compliance, quality control, and quality assurance? Mark Zuckerberg says the future is private, but his definition of privacy might not be what you think it is. Facebook has been mired in one privacy scandal or another in the last 2 years. But the way Facebook defines privacy isn't the way ordinary people might understand it. When people talk about privacy in relation to Facebook, they're referring to Facebook and its algorithms. The company has mishandled users' data repeatedly and on an unprecedented scale, while building immensely complex internal profiles of these users for advertising purposes. Facebook now plans to encrypt users' messages to one another by default. Beneath all the privacy bells and whistles and behind message encryption, the fundamental advertising machine remains basically unchanged. Facebook will still build a sophisticated picture of who you are, and so much more, which is then all fed into a set of algorithms to profile you and hyper-target you with ads. That's not privacy in any traditional sense of the word. Zuckerberg's unconventional approach to definitions extends interoperability as well. Normally, this would mean building services in such a way that they can communicate and be utilized across multiple platforms operated by different companies. But Mark Zuckerberg defined it far more narrowly than that. You should be able to use any of our apps, as he says, to reach your friends. Facebook plans to merge the back ends of Messenger, WhatsApp, and Instagram, and letting any user on one service message any service on one of the others. This is not interoperability. In the traditional competition-enhancing sense of truly open standard, real interoperability could confer huge benefits to users communicating across platforms, but this would also impact Facebook's dominance of the messaging ecosystem. Facebook's rhetoric for the last decade has repeatedly touted the benefits of openness, suggesting that worries about privacy are way overblown. The way that people think about privacy is changing a bit. Mark Zuckerberg said in an interview with Time magazine that what people want isn't complete privacy. It isn't that they want secrecy. It's that they want control over what they share and what they don't. Now faced with mounting public scrutiny and the growing risk of regulatory action, Facebook claims to be going under a major seismic change in their business model. But it does little to address broader questions about Facebook's impact on society, shies away from any truly revolutionary change that might put the company's position at risk, and leaves the company's cash printing capabilities intact. Facebook has set aside $3 billion ahead of an anticipated record FTC fine over privacy violations. Facebook is gearing up for a massive financial penalty over its repeated privacy violations. Facebook's financial success continues unabated, however, in the face of countless security and privacy scandals, including a potential record-setting Federal Trade Commission fine. The fine, the potential amount of which was first reported by the Washington Post, is related mostly to the Cambridge Analytica scandal that was revealed in March of last year, as well as a seemingly never-ending series of subsequent breaches and leaks that have dogged Facebook in the months since. The company posted first quarter earnings for 2019, highlighting its continued monthly and daily active user increases and a 26% increase in year-over-year sales up to $15.1 billion and ahead of Wall Street expectations. But Facebook also is setting aside the $3 billion, or roughly 6% of its cash and marketable securities on hand, for the FTC fine that is coming down the pipeline at some point likely this year. Facebook says it's preparing to pay as much as $5 billion in FTC fine. In the first quarter of 2019, they reasonably estimated a probable loss and recorded an accrual of $3 billion. The matter remains unresolved, and there can be no assurances as to the timing of the terms of any final outcome. The fine has impacted Facebook's record profit for the quarter, forcing it far below the first quarter of last year and negatively affecting the company's earnings per share. Regardless of all this, Facebook continues to grow, and by all indications, it would have bested all analysts' expectations had it not set aside the cash for the fine. The company says the number of people who check Facebook daily has increased by 8% from this time a year ago to 1.56 billion people. The number of people who check Facebook monthly has also grown 8% to 2.38 billion. The company says that even more of its business now relies on mobile, with 93% of all advertising revenues coming from its collection of mobile apps. Facebook now breaks out the number of people who use at least one app in its broader ecosystem. About 2.7 billion people use Facebook, WhatsApp, Instagram, or Messenger each month. The company said that on average, more than 2.1 billion people use one of their apps every day. Hampering the company's finances is a staggering increase in headcount, represented mostly by the influx of new contractors that Facebook is bringing on to try and curb abuses on the platform and sift through the deluge of content that gets uploaded every day. Facebook says it increased year-over-year employee count by 36% to nearly 37,800 total employees. The amount of money it spends on such general and administrative expense has multiplied nearly six times over to more than $4 billion from a little under $800 million this time a year ago. Facebook stock is up nearly 5% in after-hour trading, indicating that Wall Street largely doesn't seem to care about the avalanche of bad press that the social network has generated in the past couple of years, as long as its financials continue to improve. The looming FTC fine also doesn't appear to have any negative impact. Still, Facebook is facing more adversarial atmosphere, both from users who are flocking more to Instagram and private messaging products. With this pending fine, Facebook just treated it as the cost of doing business. From Marty Winston, we're going to talk about soundproofing and where is that sound coming from?
I'm deliberately recording this while the carpenter is framing the walls and without shutting out the other sounds that I try to avoid when preparing my segments. I sure could use some soundproofing, and that's what I want to cover here. Even a quiet house isn't quite quiet. Water runs through feed pipes and through drains. If you're on well and septic systems, add well pumps and sump pumps. Your heating and air conditioning blow winds through ventilation ductwork and out registers. Garage doors and lesser doors can all add noises. Outdoor weather creates its own sound sources, and those outdoor noises can also make the trip indoors. So can traffic and bird songs and dogs barking down the street. And you know that with most computers bigger than a notebook, those fans keep spinning. But let's not get crazy. Some of those sounds are part of the modern background of life. That isn't to say that you want to be exposed to the full brunt of all of them all the time. When we moved into our new-to-us 40-year-old house, I was delighted to find that its huge basement, and I mean roughly 30 feet by 50 feet, was unfinished. Let me explain why, in my context, that's a good thing. If there had already been walls up and even rooms in place, it would have been very challenging to alter them to help reduce the amount of noise in critical parts of my workspace. Right now, in addition to my radio segments on the Personal Computer Radio Show and on Ben Rockwell's show, Computer Talk Radio, I'm producing radio and television and cable TV versions of two new series, All Hands on Tech and Marty on the House. Those should start airing in July. That heightens my need to keep noise levels under control. But it's still not that different from how you might want to handle spaces in your own home, whether because you don't want noises from beyond the room getting in, or because you don't want noise from inside the room getting out. I get it. Even rock musicians want to let their babies sleep nights, and people who rock games or movies don't want to turn the volume down as low as they've been told it should go. So let's talk soundproofing. And before I start that talk, I want to be careful about defining our terms. It starts with a question: is the noise that you want to stop coming through the wall? Or is it starting inside the room you're in and bouncing off the wall? If your challenges are warehouse-like echoes that sound like you're living inside a huge sewer pipe, well, that's not what we'll be describing. Addressing those means adding a sound absorption solution like foam acoustic panels on the ceilings or the walls, things that are soft enough to absorb sound instead of bouncing it. What I want to address here is the flip side of that coin, stopping noise that starts in other rooms from getting into mine. The act of stopping that is called soundproofing. Before we moved in, I got the floor plans and started mapping out the basement. The northwest corner gets my office space. A new wall goes in just east of that. In the northeast corner space, my test bench, lab, and design facilities. The east central section would hold the mechanical systems, HVAC, and so on, plus my equipment racks, and those are noisy. West Central is a stairway with the storage trolley going underneath. Southeast is a storage area where I'll add shelving. Midway along the south wall, I'm fitting a cedar closet. And the southwest corner has an engineering closet with electrical distribution, coax cable distribution, and so on. There are lots of moving parts here. Right now, the carpenter is about halfway through framing the studs for the new walls. The electrician is coming in this week, maybe next week, to upgrade our breaker box. Our load distribution center, from 24 positions to 60. Adding whole house surge protection, adding the first 8 new wiring runs, and giving me some early access to power through temporary new outlet boxes. When I met with the crew that will be adding closed-cell polyurethane foam to the attic for thermal insulation, I learned about open-cell polyurethane foam and its acoustic insulation effectiveness at blocking acoustic noise that would otherwise come through walls. They'll spray the open-cell foam inside the basement space studs, which will go a long way to quieting things down. For the ceilings, I'll try to get in insulated, flexible, round ductwork to replace the tin tube metal ventilation ducts running up there now. It's a lot quieter. The major ductwork right at the HVAC will get insulation blankets as a thermal assist, which should also bring some noise reduction. I'll replace a lot of the copper plumbing pipes with insulated PEX. The fluorescents will get replaced by LED fixtures, so those ratty buzzes will go away. And I'll figure out some kind of drop ceiling that can add to the quiet without cutting too much into the basement's limited headroom. There's one other element that's a maybe, but I'm hoping I can get it in time. That open-cell polyurethane foam in the walls means the drywall sheets won't be able to act like big diaphragms. Think drumheads, which can work against quiet and relay noise. But there's a way to kick that up a notch. A new kind of gypsum drywall, not on the market yet, that is itself effective at cutting noise levels that come through them. But let's maintain a balance. I don't need all these measures on every wall in every room. The machine room with the HVAC gear and the noisy electronics racks, that needs to be surrounded. The office room and the lab room, which are coincidentally where a lot of the video will get shot, those will get fairly well surrounded. The storage areas, much less important. Did anybody notice what I left out? It's the flooring. We're talking with Tarkett because their ProGen flooring is a must for the rack room. It can handle full-ton racks rolling or dragging across or sledgehammers dropping, all without ever rutting or denting. And they have a noise-reducing underside. We don't need ProGen to cover the full basement, but whatever we choose for north of the central stairway will have some kind of sound absorption underneath. I'll have more to say about flooring in a couple of weeks. Next time, we want to come clean about ways your laundry gear can cause all kinds of problems beyond the things you wash and dry, and some ways to think about stopping those problems from happening. There's a lot more to it than duds and suds. Catch me next week.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need for technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. There is no such thing as a dumb question. The New York Amateur Computer Club has a meeting on Thursday, May 9th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and the topic of presentation is printer developments. It will be held at NYU, Meyer Hall, room 102, located at 4 Washington Place in Manhattan, New York. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group has a meeting on Friday, May 10th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Harry J. Scherr Hall, New York Institute of Technology, Old Westbury Campus, Old Westbury, New York. The Computer Learning Center of Ewing will have a presentation on Apple Seeds and Apple devices. Tuesday, May 14th, meeting time 2 p.m., at the Ewing Senior and Community Center at 999 Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. Kingsbite Computer Club will have a meeting on Tuesday, May 14th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Park Plaza Restaurant, 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn, New York. The Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on a look back at the club's history and a personal journey, Thursday, May the 23rd, and they meet in the Middletown Library Lodge Meeting Room, located at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. The Princeton PC Users Group will meet Tuesday, May the 28th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at the Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. The Danbury Area Computer Society has their meeting on Tuesday, June 4th. Meeting time is 7:30 p.m. and is held at the Danbury Hackerspace, 158 Main Street, Danbury, Connecticut. The Westchester PC Users Group will have a presentation on ADA's driverless cars. Thursday, June the 6th, meeting time is 7 p.m. at the Keller Williams Realty, 120 Bloomingdale Road in White Plains, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will have their meeting on Friday, June 7th. Meeting time is 8 p.m., and they meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. If you have a computer club meeting you want me to announce on the air, send me a note. My address is hank@pcradioshow.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm on the Internet. Podcasts are available from all major podcasting host sites, as well as our website, pcradioshow.org. If you have any questions for us or commentary on any of our feature segments, just send us your email address with your telephone number, in which we can call you at a convenient hour for playback on the program. If you have any questions for us, just send us your email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. There is no such thing as a stupid question. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.